We have a number of guests for this hour. Elaine Gross is the president of Erase Racism. Dori Dumas will be joining us a little bit later on, the president of the New Haven chapter of the NAACP. Aaron Kempel is also on the line with us, the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. And a little bit later on in the program, Tim Parrish will also be with us. Tim teaches in the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, at Southern Connecticut State University. He's the author of Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, a memoir. He'll talk about growing up in Baton Rouge and what it's like in Connecticut nowadays. Elaine, thank you for being with us. We appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us about Erase Racism. What is your organization about?
Well, we started in 2001, and we are a regional organization, civil rights organization, based on Long Island. We focused mostly in Nassau and Suffolk County, the two suburban counties. And we are particularly interested in identifying and addressing institutional racism, both in housing and public school education. So that means that we've done research on this issue. We've analyzed and then advocated for various public policies, whether it's government policies or with private institutions that create more racial equity. And we've educated the public and tried to activate them. And sometimes we've used legal action to achieve our objectives.
How many members in your organization?
Well, if you're talking about staff members, we're tiny. We have three full-time and two part-time, and then we always have several interns and a host of volunteers. We also have what we call partners, members of our Partnership for Racial Equity, and those are individuals that have signed on to support the mission. We call upon them if there is a public hearing, if there's some legislation that we believe should be supported, and they work with us on our programs, like our Education Equity Initiative, for example.
You sound like you operate like an NPR station.
Well, we are a nonprofit like you, and so there are some similarities.
You're having a series of forums across Long Island. Why? Why not other areas? I know that's where you're based, but what made you decide in 2001 to say this is an issue that needs to be addressed on Long Island?
Well, Long Island has some significant statistics that make it the poster child for structural racism. We are among the top 10 most racially segregated metro regions in the country. And when a lot of people think about suburbia, they think of Long Island because there's such a there's a prominent story related to Levittown as being the place after World War II. There were a lot of GIs coming back from the war. They needed places to live. They took advantage of the federal government's programs and initiatives, which allowed people to be able to put a little money down and then pay off a brand new house over time, basically being a working person, not being someone of means. The only problem is the federal government created maps and put red lines around the maps if there were African Americans living in those areas, and those became the areas that would not receive federal guarantee for mortgage loans. So basically, the black GIs and their families that came back were blocked from accessing not only this wonderful housing that was in many cases and certainly in better condition than the kind of housing that they would have gotten in the city, but they were denied a wonderful wealth building opportunity. And because most people, and I think still a lot of people, their wealth is in their home. And so, you know, Black Americans, as a sort of example of structural racism, they were structurally blocked from being able to access those homes. And it's not just what the federal government did, it's what the banking industry did and still continues to do, the real estate industry did and still continues to do. So it is, there are many reasons why it would be good for us to launch this, how do we build a just Long Island focused on addressing structural racism. Good reasons to launch it here on Long Island. Plus, we're based here on Long Island.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. We are speaking with Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism. Elaine, you described the, I believe the phrase you used before is that Long Island is the poster child for racism. Is redlining still prevalent on Long Island today?
And just one clarification. What I said was structural racism.
Structural.
And the reason why I make that distinction is because most people think of racism as, you know, there are good individuals and bad individuals. And the bad individuals are the ones that, you know, everybody knows. Maybe they belong to the KKK and, you know, things of that nature. The thing about structural racism, it doesn't require good people, bad people, that kind of thing. I mean, in terms of one or the other. The fact is, everybody, if you don't take aggressive action to do otherwise, then the status quo will continue. And that's why we're having these forums, is to help people understand the difference between this institutional and structural racism, the way that policies can do the work of what the old, you know, Jim Crow racists, if people think of it in those terms, of what those individuals did. The ones that are sort of spewing hate and, you know, it's kind of obvious where they're coming from.
So if I could clarify it a bit, so that means if I'm just going to use myself as an example. And if mm-hmm. I say that, okay, I'm not racist and I tried to be colorblind, but still I may participate in activities that have that structural racism built into it, that I need to be aware of those habits that I have that maybe I just take for granted nowadays, and to try and force a change in that?
Yeah, you need to be aware of how structural racism operates. So, for example, on Long Island, we have 125 school districts that mirror the residential segregation. So people look at the schools and they say, oh, the schools are still segregated. Well, it must be that those, you know, those Black and brown kids, you know, aren't really smart, or they don't really want to learn, or all of those kinds of things. And what we discovered when we did research between 2004 and 2016, even though Long Island, it has been becoming more and more diverse over the years, that in fact, that doesn't mean our schools were becoming less segregated. And so we even went in the wrong direction for the intensely segregated districts with 90 to 100% non-white. We tripled the number of students that were attending those kind of districts during that 12-year period from 2004 to 2016. And the actual number of districts, we started out with 5 in 2004, ended up with 11 in 2016. So if children are only allowed to go to schools according to their zip code, and if they are in these residentially segregated communities, and I told you we're among the top 10 most residentially segregated by race, then the children are being slotted in to schools, and it's structural. So it's not that you as a resident, you know, say, okay, I only want the Black and brown children to go to these districts. Well, you don't have to say that. You know, it is built in to the system.
Racism in all forms for people of color, for women because of sexual orientation, gender, is that what we're talking about when we talk about racism?
Well, we don't use racism for all of those things, but there are structural impediments that relate to gender, that relate to a variety of things. And I think that the thing about racism is that it has such a long history in the United States that the way we were developed in the first place, the whole business around the enslavement of Africans, the racial hierarchy, that blacks were on the bottom of the racial hierarchy in the mind of many, not quite human, some portion human, not 100%. And so we have just, over the years, there are so many laws and regulations starting out being very overt, but then now continuing.
Elaine, hold on one moment. We have to take a short break. Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism, is with us. We'll be continuing our conversation and bring in a few other guests. When we come back, we're going to have a short break. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. Today, we're talking about erasing racism, a series of forums taking place on Long Island. We're doing it with Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism. Elaine, before I bring in some of our other guests, I have to tell you that this is a difficult conversation to have. The reason I say that is because I know tomorrow we'll be speaking with those experts about global warming, and they will sit here and they'll say, we must do this, this, and this. Get rid of your car. Take public transportation. Cut down on your carbon emissions. Do certain things because the sake of the planet now is it's in our hands. We have to take care of the future. Racism, from what you're saying to me, is the same thing, because this is going to require a good look at our habits and saying, well, maybe I'm not racist, but what I do and maybe where I go, it's structural racism, and that needs to change.
Well, you began by saying it's a challenging conversation, and that's why we set up these forums, because it's not a conversation that people have. And we actually arranged to have 5 forums. They're all on the same topic in a matter of 2 weeks. And the reason for that is because Long Island's very long. And so we've been in Stony Brook and Riverhead and Hempstead. Earlier this morning, we were right in the business corridor with a forum that was co-hosted by the Long Island Association, the business association here. And then on Monday, our last forum will be in HAPA, co-hosted by the State of Black Long Island Equity Council, convened by the Urban League. And we have been getting a very interesting group of people, a very diverse group of people, and they have been coming out in droves. We've had anywhere from 250 to, on the lower side, it was still over 100. So the response has been very enthusiastic, and I think the timing is right. We didn't know that we would luck up in this way to have this kind of timing, but I think that people are ready to step out, have the conversation, and they're asking about the next steps, which is exactly what we wanted them to do. We want them to move toward action after they educate themselves more on the topic.
Let me bring in Aaron Kempel, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Aaron, thank you for being with us. Thank you for patiently waiting. You've been listening to the conversation from the Connecticut perspective. How do you see it?
Thank you so much for having me. And Elaine, it's good to hear you speak and to know that there's other people working on these issues, because, as you say, there are issues, and there are issues throughout the country as well as in the areas that of Connecticut. It's kind of surprising, I think, to a lot of people that the Northeast is the home to many of the most segregated areas in the country. And in fact, the Bridgeport-Stamford area ranks number 6 in the country when you're looking at white Latino segregation, while Hartford ranks number 9. So it is an issue throughout the Northeast, and I think a lot of the reason for that Elaine has already hit on, which is that there were a lot of systemic issues that were started and maintained by the government. So, for instance, in addition to redlining, which is still a problem in Connecticut, and I'll talk about that in a minute, there's also the placement of public and subsidized housing. And so if you look at where public and subsidized housing is located, it's located in areas where there are already many, many poor people and also people of color, so that there is a lot of segregation that is coming just because of where we place our housing. And I think the Levittown issues are very important, because in addition to having redlining that went on there, there was also something called restrictive covenants. And so if you bought a house in Levittown, there was a specific clause in your deed that said you couldn't transfer that house to anyone who was not a person of the Caucasian race. And we also have those restrictive covenants here in Connecticut. They're not enforceable anymore, but it explains, I think, why we see the kind of segregation that we do. So it's an issue that we're working on. It's an issue that I think needs continued attention, because as we know from lots of research these days, where you live has an effect on all parts of your life. It's going to determine where your kids go to school. It's going to determine who your health care providers are. It's going to determine where you get a job and how you get to that job. You were talking earlier about the issues with regards to the climate change. In a lot of places in Long Island and in Connecticut, the option of taking public transportation to get to work is not an option. There isn't the kind of public transportation that you see in major metropolitan areas like New York City. So housing and racism and the other kinds of discrimination against people based upon their religion or national origin are things that are really affecting all parts of our society today.
Dori Dumas is the president of the New Haven chapter of the NAACP. Dori, thank you for patiently waiting. Can you give us your thoughts, please, as to what you've been hearing?
I will have to say that for the Greater New Haven branch, we've been fighting over 100 years because racism has been rooted in every area in the United States. But we're fighting injustice, promoting equality, and putting a spotlight on any and all biases towards any citizen in the Greater New Haven community, and when needed, beyond. So we see it. It's, racism, hate, that's embedded in people. It's taught, it's been passed on. So we know that, you know, it's not just in the South and it's not just in the past, it's present. We hear stories every day, we get complaints every day, and we're fighting. We have significant challenges around race, white supremacy, and discrimination. And so our job for the NAACP is to hold people accountable, to point it out, to work on change and advancement. And it's not an easy fight, and it's an ongoing everyday fight, but it's one that we know is important and necessary. So in the Greater New Haven, and we cover, our branch covers 13 towns and states, but throughout the state of Connecticut, we are working together, because we hear about these kinds of stories and things happening, and they have been happening, and it's not a thing of the past. It is our present, and it is very unfortunate because we don't have the same access. We don't have the same opportunities. We're still having doors closed, and what doors we have open, we're kind of trying to make sure they stay open because of things like racism and discrimination.
Elaine Gross, I would like to read an email to you from Mike from Waterbury, and he writes, how much of an impact do sports, and more importantly, athletes like Muhammad Ali, Colin Kaepernick, and LeBron James have on society as a whole when it comes to social change?
We know, obviously, that people in high-profile positions have, you know, influence a certain segment of the population. I'm not sure exactly what the, you know, what the writer was getting at there. But I think that a lot more happens because of ordinary citizens, which is why we're trying to activate Long Islanders. I think that the voice of a lot of Long Islanders standing up for racial equity will have a tremendous impact. We know that also for New York State, we organized a statewide coalition that's working on making legal source of income a protected class so that people cannot be discriminated against because they have a housing choice voucher or they have, veterans benefits or disability benefits or whatever. A landlord can't say, oh, no, I'm only going to take your wage income into consideration to decide whether or not you're going to have enough money in order to pay for the rent. So I know that there's a lot of attention on celebrities in one way or another, whether it's positive attention or negative. But I think that our focus really needs to be on all of the people, the teachers and the business people and the parents and, you know, across various sectors. Those are the folks that we are educating and activating with the forums that we have.
Erin Kemple from the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. It sounds from what Elaine Gross is saying that Connecticut and Long Island are not that far apart. Very similar.
She's absolutely right about that. And in fact, I would say that most of the Northeast is not different. You know, there are rural places like Vermont and Maine, but there are urban areas like in Boston and New York and Long Island. But I think that the history and the legacy of segregation is similar in all areas. Again, there wasn't so much. There was individual acts of discrimination, and I'm sure that there are people in the audience who experienced individual acts of discrimination, especially based upon race. But there was also a lot of policies coming from the federal government. We're all still experiencing, and I know this is true on Long Island, and some of the exclusionary zoning that's done in order to keep multifamily or affordable housing out of certain areas. And that keeps people of color out of those areas. And so I think we are all looking at the same issues, and I think we're all trying to overcome the same issues. With regards to redlining, it can be a lot more subtle than going into a bank and having the person say, no, I won't give you a loan because of the color of your skin. But in fact, we did testing here in Connecticut and in Fairfield County, in which a person who was Latino walked into a bank and asked for information about getting a loan and was told, oh, we don't do lending in this bank. And then a short time later, we sent in someone who is white, who was given a lot of information and was offered to speak to a loan officer, and the person who is Latino was turned away without giving that kind of information. So it's all part of the same thing, but it's still something that I think we're all still grappling with.
Dory Dumas.
I was going to say, we have a program here in New Haven, and we were able to secure a grant to help with funding for down payment assistance and for people who wouldn't normally get the same treatment at a bank or be able to apply because of, you know, credit scores are not exactly where they should be, but they're close enough. So we have a program and we secured a grant where we give an extra $10,000 for down payment assistance because we realize that some people in Connecticut are paying more for rent than they would be if they were able to get a mortgage. But because of racism and other things that happen, they're not able to apply and get the loans the same way. So we set something up to say, here is at least one solution and one way to help. It's not nearly enough, but we do feel like when we look at the rates of how many people rent and how many people own, that people of color are not owning at the same rate, and one of it is because they don't have the opportunity or access. So we're trying to remove barriers. I heard someone talking about transportation. We've been dealing with that. We have people who can't get a job because the bus system stops at a certain time, so they can get there, but they can't get home, or they have to wait for hours. So all of those things are barriers that really affect people of color, are things that the NAACP is working towards and trying to make change, because we really know that, you know, in order for us to have advancement and have fair treatment and have people to have the same access, we have to really look at the way we are structured and the way things are happening and change them for so that everyone has that same access.
Dori Dumas, can I ask you to comment on something that Aaron Kemple said a short time ago, talking about affordable housing going into certain areas? You know that there is some homeowners who are saying, look, it sounds great, but I don't want affordable housing in my area because if it comes in, my property will go down in value. How do you respond to that?
Well, we've heard that. And we've actually, with our housing authority, they won a big case to actually, in the Hamden area, there were people who did not want to open up a road because they felt like that road, which was around affordable housing, would bring down their value. And that did not happen. So even in today, and it's not, you know, there is discrimination around low income and low housing, and people do feel that way. But we're trying to educate people that that is not the case. And, you know, we definitely see that. We've been fighting against that. Now, they opened up this area, and that has not happened in that area. Now, it's only been a couple of years, but we see that there's a fight. People come out in big numbers to say that they don't want affordable housing in their area because this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And really, the facts show that, and the data shows that that has not happened.
Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism. I think you may have heard what I said at the beginning of the program. Many people think, look, it's not as bad as it was back in the 50s, back in the 60s. Has the situation improved?
It has improved in certain ways. You know, most of us, not all of us, most of us can walk down the street and not be afraid of being killed or strung up, lynched, etc. I made that qualifier because we know what's been happening with, in terms of Black Lives Matter around the police. But I do think that some of the structural things, which we've all been saying, are still happening. I mean, we hear those same kinds of complaints about, no, we don't want affordable housing here. And, you know, even when there's research that says, no, it's not bringing down the property values, people hold on to the myths. And, you know, it's difficult to combat myths with facts if people aren't willing to look at the data and to accept the facts. And I think it makes our job harder, but I believe that the more people we're able to gather up to affirm what we're talking about, sometimes it makes a difference if your peer says it and not the expert, you know? So sometimes it helps if there are people that you perceive to be just like you who are saying, no, this isn't a problem. No, I'm for this. I see the benefits in our racial integration. Sometimes that has even a more a greater impact than an expert citing the statistics.
We are speaking with Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism, Dori Dumas, the president of the New Haven chapter of the NAACP, and Aaron Kemple, the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. When we come back from our break, Tim Parrish will be joining us. Tim teaches in the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, at Southern Connecticut State University. And he is the author of Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, a memoir. He'll tell us about growing up in Baton Rouge and what it's like being in Connecticut nowadays. You are listening to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. A short break. We'll be right back. We're talking about racism. I want to bring in one last guest. He's been very patient. Tim Parrish is going to join us now for a few minutes. Tim teaches in the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at Southern Connecticut State University. He's the author of Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, a memoir. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I just want to first say that I want to thank Aaron, Elaine, and Dory for that great overview of structural and socioeconomic covert racism, which is something people in the North are in great denial about, I think.
Well, and that brings us to our first question for you, because you grew up in Baton Rouge, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
You describe yourself in the book as a working-class racist. What made you change?
Well, it's a long story, but I was raised in a culture by what would be considered normal people. And again, I want to stress that point that I think Elaine first made, that, you know, most racists aren't these hood-wearing, tiki torch-carrying caricatures. They're folks you're around every day and people who probably, in most instances, won't reveal that they're racist in an obvious way. But, yes, I was raised working class, and I was in a neighborhood that was naturally desegregating, and I was part of sort of first wave white flight, which, as the title of my book says, was caused mostly by fear. And I was involved in a lot of racial violence in my high school, which were basically gang fights based on race. And my senior year, I was finally involved in a fight and suspended for a week. And my father, who was a racist, stepped up and kind of intervened. And also a couple of black fellow athletes, I think, took really courageous stands in talking to me and sort of brought me around, as did a couple of teachers.
What brought you up north?
Well, I got a job. That's the most motivating factor anywhere.
That'll do it.
It is, yeah.
And how do you compare Connecticut to your upbringing?
Well, you know, it's radically different in terms of geography and just, I think, sort of, even though the urban centers in the South are becoming much more progressive, I still think that race is the subtext of a lot of conversations in the South, and there's still a kind of, I call it zealous ignorance and pride in being racist in the South, and much segregation as there is in the North. You know, Elaine touched on urban centers here and the level of desegregation and still white flight, or at least white paranoia. So I'd say the North and the South are very similar in those respects. And if you get very far outside of urban centers in Connecticut, or if I do, I can quickly forget that I'm in even a progressive state, because I think a lot of the entrenched ideas are the same.
I was speaking with a colleague last night, and she was saying, do some of these problems that you're talking about, do they really exist? Are some people, not everyone, but are some people in and around this area in denial?
A lot of people are. In fact, at a lot of readings I've done in the Northeast, people want to ask me about racism in the South, and I almost always redirect that to questions about racism in the North. A lot of times, I focus, again, on kind of inherent racism, which some of your previous guests have talked about as well, people not being aware that there is racism in there that's deeply wired, as it is in me, and controlled by stereotypes that we have to, and I still have to, deprogram a lot. And I spoke to some high school students a couple of weeks ago, and the way I posed it to them was asking these white kids, if they were walking in a particular neighborhood late at night and they were black, do they think anyone would have stopped them? I would ask them, have they ever talked to black friends about walking in department stores and being tracked or being asked why they were there, and is that experience similar to them or to their experiences? So I think there's a lot of self-examination that white people need to do, and it's very hard work, and it takes constant vigilance.
Tim, before I turn it back to Aaron, Dory, and Elaine, how did you deprogram that, as you put it, zealous ignorance?
I have not deprogrammed it. It's still in me. On bad days, I have the same sort of internal reactions to people of color that I would have had at any time in my life. And I think one thing white people need to learn in general is you can't get rid of how you were programmed. What you can do is bring reason and an awareness of how you're reacting because of that wiring, because it is a sort of indoctrination, and you can't be ashamed of it. I think one obstacle in white people dealing with racism is they feel as though they're going to be chastised or ostracized, which probably in most cases is sort of ridiculous, And so they don't want to take that extra effort of admitting it and then moving forward.
Elaine Gross, the president of Erase Racism, you're listening to Tim Parrish. Are you agreeing?
Well, I would say that we use somewhat different language. I think part of what he's saying we talked about at our forum this morning as implicit bias, which is our automatic brain working, and we're not even necessarily aware of some of the decisions that we're making, that they are racialized decisions. For example, we have so many messages in the media all over that repeat the inferiority of black people.
And could you give me an example, please?
Well, if you look at some of the images, one of the things that were brought up was the floods, you know, the Katrina floods, and you have a newspaper article. Both people are, you know, they have some food. It looks like they went to get some food, and the water is really high. And for the black person, the caption talks about looting. For the white person, it talks about trying to find food. Do you know? There are the soap advertisements, the Dove advertisements, which has a before and after. And you see a black person, and then it gets lighter, and then the white person is the after. They're subtle messages that say there's something wrong with you if you're a black person. And sometimes it's not so subtle. I mean, you know, there was a television news spot, and they had a picture of the person that was actually the victim of a crime. It was an African American. But the way they did the picture and the way they were talking about the crime, you thought the African American was the criminal, when in fact, that was the person who was victimized. And they showed the little video of the white person planting some drugs in a store. But the whole news story was about, you know, the store owner having some items which were questionable, you know, and somebody who catches that quickly as a news program, they're going to automatically say, okay, the black person was the bad guy, unless they look closely and see, oh, no, the black person was actually the victim.
Dori Dumas, president of the New Haven chapter of the NAACP, I'm glad we're having this conversation, but it's somewhat depressing because it just seems that we have such a long way to go.
We do have a long way to go, but we have to start somewhere. And I think having conversations, having forums, talking honest, really straight talk helps. So, I mean, one is starting, if you have to talk about it, talk about it at the, you know, level. I love that, the professor was talking about talking to young people because we want to start there. But when we see it, right, if we don't speak out against it, it is as if we're giving consent to it. So when people see it, whether you see it or not, or if someone brings it to your attention, then we have to say, yeah, that's not okay. I understand. That's not a thing of the past. We can't sweep it under the carpet or act like, because it's uncomfortable or not an easy conversation, that it shouldn't be a conversation that we're having in several different forms and ways. So I do appreciate you talking about it today on the radio. I appreciate all the work that the other guests are doing, because I think it takes all of us. We all play a part. We all have a part. And I think that if it has to start with conversations and really being honest about it, then that's a good start. We have to start somewhere.
Erin Kempel, the executive director of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center, do you find a generational gap? Do you find younger people willing to speak out to you nowadays, willing to say now this is wrong, and they're much more proactive?
I think it really depends upon where the person was raised and how they were raised. So one of the things that I find encouragement from is that it really is true that if you live with people, or you go to school with people, or you work with people, people who are different from you, people are who are not of the same race or ethnicity, then you do have a greater tolerance and you do have a greater understanding of the issues that they live with throughout their lives. And so I think that that's really encouraging. What I see is that more people who are young were raised in environments that were multicultural and multiracial, and I think that has made a big difference, so that they are not thinking it's a big deal to have their roommate or their husband or their spouse be someone who is a person of color or of different race or ethnicity, and that is a difference. But I also find that it very, you know, it's hard to say yes, everybody this or everybody that, and certainly that's not something we really have ever done. We don't want to continue in our society. So I think that it's something that we're all working on, and I think there has been some progress, but I think that everybody who's on the call agrees that without some conscious and deliberate decisions to address it and to look at it, it's not really ever going to change.
Well, Tim Parrish, that's what you wrote. If I could read part of that, it goes back to what Aaron was saying. You wrote that white people of all classes need to take a hard, difficult look at their own ingrained patterns of thought and reaction.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And again, I think this show is really a template for people to understand both the kind of micro issues, but especially the macro issues. But yeah, it's... you know, I've actually have become somewhat discouraged over the last 5 years talking about this, because there's a lot of diversion when you get close to talking about racism. And people, strangely enough, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are still targets, even for people whom I doubt have ever seen Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. But when you start to get close to, when I start to get close to talking about racism with most people, they want to, with white people, they want to turn it toward talking about what black people do, inner-city crime, these other things. And then they don't want to hear when I go back to them, that's a different topic, and it's also a justification of racism and stereotyping that they don't even understand. And I find most people reluctant to deal with that. I do want to say this about my students as well. I think it was Aaron who said that it depends a lot on locale and the community, but I find... I teach a lot more progressive students now, and being in a diverse population of all sorts is much more normalized for them, and that's encouraging to me.
I have to agree with you somewhat, and I know I don't speak to young people across the state, but the ones that I've known, they seem to take equality almost for granted nowadays, and they
do take it for granted.
But in terms of if I talk with them about racism, they just look at me kind of funny because they don't understand why anybody would be racist, why someone would be sexist. It's a new generation with new values coming up, and quite frankly, it's wonderful.
I wouldn't say that's true at all levels, though.
Because I speak a lot at college campuses in the greater New Haven community, and they're still dealing with it on the college campus. Some get it, some don't. But the more that get it and the more we talk about it, discuss it, and make sure that people understand, then I think we are moving forward. So it's not everyone, because when we go to the college campuses, sometimes we're going because we're reacting to something that's already happened that really was unfortunate on the campus, or racism on the campus. But for the most part, I think you're right. The more, especially in, you know, in the schools when it's a little bit more diverse and, you know, they're starting to understand each other, accept each other a little bit more, that is better. Okay, that's advancement. But it also is they're coming sometimes from homes where it was taught and it is okay. And so then it's not everyone. So I don't want us to say that a whole lot, but it's better.
It is better. 3 minutes left. Quick thoughts from all of you. Elaine Gross, president of Erase Racism, please tell us about your forums and what you have planned for the future.
We have one more forum left, and we do have a few seats for that. It's Monday, December 10th at 6 o'clock at the Radisson Hotel in Hop Hog. And they can sign up online, ErasedRacismNY.org. NHCP.org.
Dori Dumas, president of the New Haven chapter of the NAACP, I'm sure that you would invite people to join your organization.
We absolutely do. You can join. There's branches throughout the state of Connecticut. Next Saturday, we're having a meeting with the governor-elect and Black leaders across the state to make sure, as he gets ready to go into office, that he is having representation from the Black community. So we are always doing the work of civil rights and trying to end racism. So please join the NAACP and get involved if you care, because when you're silent, you are given consent.
And when are you meeting with Governor-elect Lamont?
Saturday, December 15th. I don't have a calendar in front of me. I believe that's the 15th, but it's next Saturday at the Hilton in Hartford. So we'll be meeting with him, with leaders throughout the state of Connecticut, and we're talking about what his leadership team looks like and making sure we have representation. So we don't want to be reactive. We're trying to be proactive, and we want to hold him accountable to our communities, because when you look at who turned out to vote, especially for him in this past election, it was a lot of people of color. So he owes it to us to at least hear from us and make sure that we're well represented so that we can have fair treatment and access as well.
Erin Kemple, how can people get in contact with the Connecticut Fair Housing Center?
People absolutely should call us if they think that they have been the victim of housing discrimination by dialing 860-247-4400. We have staff who speak Spanish and English. We also have the ability to get translation into any kind of into any language, including Creole, which I know is big down in the Fairfield area. What we will do is we will take down information, we'll do an investigation to see if we can find evidence, and if we find evidence of discrimination, we have lawyers on staff who can represent people. But also I urge the housing providers, landlords, and real estate agents to be educated on the fair housing laws. It's now a law in Connecticut that if you're going to get your real estate license renewed, you must get fair housing training. But even if you're not a real estate agent, it's a good business practice to know and understand the laws that apply to your business.
Tim Parrish, Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, a memoir. You can buy it on Amazon. Tim, Erin, Dori, Elaine, thank you all. I appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Full Story. We'll see you tomorrow.